Hey there, ladies and gentlemen, and automotive enthusiasts from all the 17 corners of the planet Earth. It's that time once again. Time for another...
another confabulated episode of V8 Radio, Kevin.
Ain't that the truth?
How about it?
Confabulated?
Yes, sir. That means to engage in conversation.
How do you use that in a sentence?
I
confabulated my friend.
Yes, exactly.
That doesn't sound
sure.
Good.
Sure. No, it doesn't sound right, but it works for our purposes.
Engaged him in a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you're all being confabulated through the magic of podcasts. And this, of course, is V8 Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Oostie, joined as always by our esteemed co-host, Mr. Mike Cuball Clark. And one thing that's unique on this show, well, not really, others do it too. But one thing that we do is fire off some automotive trivia questions right in the very beginning of the show, which sometimes gives us the excuse to call this an automotive show.
Sometimes it's our only automotive content.
That's right. That's right. Much as we try.
Right.
So, Mr. Cuball, can you confabulate me with a trivia question?
Absolutely, Kevin. It would be my pleasure. All right, here we go.
Oh, man.
I think we've had this question before in a slightly different form, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And this question, again, comes courtesy of our good friend, Frank Simkowski.
Wow.
Yeah, he's feeding me. I love it.
Yeah, good for you. He actually offered to feed me a question, but I'll keep that as a reserve. Just in case, like, I'm, you know, way out of time or something, and the show,
I see,
the time to do this just pops up and I need to grab something out of thin air, I'll grab Frank's question. So I appreciate that, Frank.
Sure thing. All right, here we go. All right, Kevin. In the 60s, Carter had the AFB carburetor, which was standard on many Mopars. Later, the AFB was replaced with the Carter AVS carburetor. What did AFB and AVS stand for?
Some great abbreviations in automotive American car history right there. So the Carter AFB was constructed out of a material that people in other countries call aluminium.
Interesting.
And here we just call it aluminum. And I'm learning that it's actually spelled with an extra I in different parts of the world. Aluminium,
really?
It's not just a pronunciation of aluminum. Uh-huh. Aluminium is actually a word. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was talking to a guy on the phone, and he kept talking about wanting some aluminium parts in his car that we're building for him. And I looked it up. I'm like, am I the idiot here? You know, because usually I am. And I learned that aluminium is a thing, and they're universally interchangeable.
Oh, interesting. That's cool.
So then I felt like pushing my aluminum on the world. But I digress. So the Carter AFB stands for aluminium four barrel. And the Carter AVS, I might get the first word wrong. I want to say, I know the first word's wrong. Can I get a portion of this right?
Absolutely.
So it's a vacuum secondary carburetor. So the VS stands for vacuum secondaries.
Okay.
But the A, I don't know if it's, I just, my mind is just going to automatic, but that ain't right. It could be aluminum vacuum secondary. Because a regular Carter AFB could have had a mechanical linkage too. So that's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with the A means aluminum in both of them. And it's four barrel and vacuum secondary.
Okay. All right. Kevin says aluminum four barrel and aluminum vacuum secondaries. Duly noted, my good friend.
We'll find out.
We'll find out at the end of the show.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this is fun. This question I got for you.
Great. I hope I get it.
What is the highest posted speed limit in the world And the bonus is, where is it located?
Ooh. This feels like a bit of a trick question.
How?
Well, isn't part sections of the Autobahn unlimited speed?
I don't know. That was a trick right there.
That's why it feels like a trick question to me.
You were trying to coax an answer out of me there, I think.
No, well, I'm not above it. What can I say? I'm 0 for the century so far this year, and I need to get one right. All right. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to say the German Autobahn. The speed limit is unlimited, and it's in, you know, the German Autobahn.
The Autobahn.
Autobahn. Das ist gut.
I'm duly noting this right now.
I dig it.
Okay.
I'd like to travel that Autobahn one time.
I would too.
Yeah, that'd be something.
That would. It'd be fast, depending on what you're driving, I guess.
Unlimited speed, probably.
We'll find out.
Well played, sir. Well played.
Man. I sound like I'm kind of wiped out, but I'm kind of here, so.
That's good.
You couldn't slip that one past me.
Dig it.
Yeah. So we have a lot going on these days, and we've gotten some really good feedback from some listeners, so I thought today maybe we can touch base on a couple of questions that we got from listeners.
Yeah, let's do it.
One of them, actually, that you were asking about, the other day we posted a picture of a 69 Camaro in Hugger Orange that is wearing a set of Firestone wide oval radials.
Indeed. I wanted to know more about that.
Yeah, those are pretty cool. So those are sold through Coker, and I think they've got a hand in the manufacturing, actually. I think it's a licensed brand of Firestone tire. And they went through a lot of trials and tribulations to try and make a modern radial tire that appears like a bias ply, because it's more than just the words on the side.
Sure.
So what we're talking about is this Camaro had what appeared to be a set of vintage classic Firestone wide oval tires, but they are essentially new, and they are a radial tire and not a bias ply like you could get back in 69.
Those certainly look like a bias ply tire.
They do.
Sidewall and tread and everything.
The sidewall is, especially from the profile of the car, it looks really nice.
Yeah.
The giveaway on a bias ply tire is that the sidewall bulges out, and then the tread kind of stands up straight off the sidewall, almost like a crew cut, if you will.
Sure. That's a good analogy.
And a radial tire doesn't have that high crew cut. It just... And the sidewall doesn't bulge as much, and it has kind of a lesser transition between the sidewall and the... It's more of a 90-degree thing instead of a little swoopy with the crew cut on it.
Gotcha.
So what they had to do is come up with a process to be able to make the tread kind of wrap around and look like the bias ply, in addition to putting period correct, accurate, wide oval lettering on it on the side. And it's, you know, raised white letter tire. And they come in a bunch of sizes and, you know, for muscle cars, and they really are very convincing.
I'd call that a win. I mean, it looked like the real McCoy when I was looking at that picture.
Yeah. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know.
True.
So if you, you want to get a set of those, hit up our friends at Coker. There was development on a counterpart to that, a Goodyear version, which of course was the Polyglass and the Polyglass GT, which was a bias ply tire back then.
Right.
And I saw a radial version of that, but they didn't. The one thing that bothered me is the tread wrapped around the contact patch area and into the sidewall, like, I think about an inch.
That's kind of a giveaway.
Well, it wasn't so much a giveaway, but it was just odd looking.
Oh. Like, they didn't quite get it down, but they still released it.
Yeah, and I don't know that I've seen those for sale. I remember I saw one of them in person at the McCacken show, actually. Hmm. A good friend of ours, Russ, sells all kinds of, you know, vintage tires and tires for vintage cars and stuff, and a lot of Goodyear stuff. And he had one on display, and we were looking at it, and it was pretty cool because I would love to have a Goodyear polyglass in a radial.
Oh, for sure.
You know, just because certain cars, that's what they came with. And
well, what did your RIV come with?
My RIV came with a double white pinstripe tire.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it a radial or was it a bias ply?
It was a bias ply in 1970.
Okay.
And today I've got a set of BFG radial TAs on it, which, you know, they're not a bad tire. We don't have a lot of choices these days for raised white letter tires.
Right.
And raised white letter tires on a Riviera is a little bit of a mismatch too, because it's more of a luxury car. But, you know, in my case, mine's a stripper and it doesn't have any luxury in it. So I'm kind of pushing the muscle side of it, you know, so it kind of fits the personality. But one of our customers had a reproduction set of Goodyear polyglass GTs. I don't know if they were GTs or regular polyglass. The difference is the sidewall aspect. The regular polyglass was a 70 series sidewall, and a polyglass GT was a 60, so they were a little shorter. But it was on a car that you might have seen, that blue 72 Formula 455.
Oh, and how?
And we did a video on it and showed the before and after, because he wanted to put Pontiac Rally 2 wheels on it.
Right.
And it had the dog dish painted steelies when it came in, and those Goodyear polyglass tires on it.
So beautiful.
They were 15-inch tires, so he's like, you know, make me an offer, and I could have a set of bias plies for the RIV.
Really?
Yeah, because they'd fit. I just, I need a secondary wheel program, because I like to drive that car distances.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I want to be doing it on bias ply all the time.
Okay, I can see that. So, you know, around town or to a cruise or something, you can use the bias plies for just for, you know, authentic purposes.
But if I'm going to go, you know, to visit you in the Chicago area and drive 350 miles and it starts raining,
and
I'm on the interstate.
That's probably good policy.
In a four-wheel drum brake car
that's
50 how many years old.
And higher speeds than what they normally went back in, you know, 1970.
Right.
So, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
All right, I'll go along with that.
Yeah. Or I could just, you know, go get the set of Firestone wide oval radials from Coker, and that's an option too.
Have the best
too,
of both worlds, yeah.
Yep, and that's why they do that, so. Mm-hmm. Maybe that is the answer right there.
Hey, I think we had a breakthrough.
We had a gestalt.
Nice.
Another fun thing that happened this past week was, and I don't know if you saw this too, but we posted a picture of a couple pictures of a black 76 Corvette on our social pages. And this car came in.
I'm embarrassed to say I missed that.
Yeah, well, that's okay. This one, we had a customer overseas, actually, and he called us saying he used to have a black 78 Corvette, and he always wanted to replace it because he missed it. But, you know, like everybody else, he wanted a more reliable car than a 1978 Corvette.
Right.
And something that performed a little bit better. So he... In many ways, he kind of got lucky because they made a lot of those mid-late 70s Corvettes, and the market is not there yet on those cars, you know.
True.
Because I think the even the L82 V8 that you could get in 76 was only like 150 horsepower or something.
Right.
I mean, it was really pathetic. So But thinking about, you know, getting one just basically for the body and then modifying it to perform better, it's, you know, not a bad way to go if you like that style.
Yeah.
So he asked us to help him find one, and I said, what color? And he said, black with a tan interior, and it would be the fantasy. And sure enough, I find him a 76, and it was black with a tan interior.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and the 76 and 78 still look the same, look similar.
Sure.
I think 79 was the first year for the big back window. 78 or 9 was. So this one still has the buttress recessed rear window.
Oh, right on. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like the earlier ones, which looks good. But it is a big plastic bumper car, you know, unlike the earlier C3s. And anyway, I find this car for him, and it really wasn't very expensive. I mean, like 10 grand.
Wow.
Like that. And it's got nice shiny paint. And when it came to our shop, we found out that it had a GM crate motor installed. It had a ZZ2. And the ZZ2 350 was made up until the mid-90s. And then the ZZ3 replaced it. But it's a... it's like a 345 horsepower motor, you know, 400 and some foot pounds of torque.
Wow.
So yeah, it ran real strong.
That's killer. 10 grand. That's a steal.
And it's a 4-speed car.
Ah.
So it's a stick, and you know, it looked pretty decent. So we changed a bunch of stuff on it. We added fuel. Well, we kind of assessed the health of the motor and found out that it was fine. And we fixed a couple leaks on it. Mm-hmm. And then, put a Holley fuel injection system on it, and then we ditched the 4-speed for a 5-speed, a TKO 600, and put that in there, and then did some brake upgrades. And inside, the tan interior was just kind of worn out, so our interior shop put new seat covers on and you know, refurbed the door panels and made all that stuff crisp and new again. And it was a nice project. The car really didn't fight us, and drove really nice, fun to drive. So the day comes when it's time to send it home. And typically, and I told you about this, you know where this
you
is
did.
Going.
I know where this is going. This
yeah,
is
typically we have a transporter that we have a great relationship with. His name is Brad Allen Transport, and he's local. His home base is local to our shop. It's not very far. And on any given day, we have this guy running all over the country, picking up cars and bringing them home. And this particular transport, however, was going to be international. So it involved a one-way ride from our shop to the coast, where it gets on a container ship and then it goes overseas. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit out of our regular transporter's wheelhouse, because the transport company handled basically door to door.
Sure.
So this guy, first of all, they blow us off like 5 times. You know, they keep saying, you better have that thing ready 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And then, you know, nobody ever shows up.
Right.
So it made us appreciate our regular transporter much more, because
certainly
the schedules are, you know, are there at least. So finally this guy shows up, and he's got a Dodge, I should say a Ram diesel truck. And it was either a crew or a mega cab, I believe, with no bed. And then he had a fifth wheel trailer. That's the giant ramp.
Yeah.
You know, where you can put 3 or 4 cars on it.
Oh yeah.
You've seen those.
Sure.
So it's not a semi, and I was kind of expecting an enclosed car hauling semi, but it wasn't. It was this guy, and you know, that's okay. He had a 7 Series BMW on the trailer, and then he was going to put this Corvette up there. So he comes running into the shop, and Trevor is all freaked out, because this dude does not know how to drive a stick.
Golly.
So here we have an automobile transport professional that cannot drive a percentage of the automobiles created. And not only that, he's telling Trevor, can you teach me how to drive stick today on this car going up this trailer ramp?
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
No.
Absolutely not.
So, you know, it became kind of a thing, because it can get dicey when you hand off a vehicle to somebody else. I mean, you got to make sure that they know what they're doing.
Sure.
And who's responsible for what. So our team kind of sprang into action, and we landed on an acceptable solution for our side, which is we would have Trevor drive the car onto the ramp, provided that the transport company gives us a release saying that it's okay for Trevor to drive it up on the ramp. And then that is the only responsibility we have, is physically getting the car on the trailer, and they're responsible for tying it down.
Perfect.
And moving it from there. And that they have to ensure that whenever it gets to its next location, somebody who knows how to drive a stick shift will remove it from the from the trailer.
Oh, man. What a gaggle.
Oh my gosh. You know, so it added, you know, an hour and a half to this guy's journey because he's standing around not knowing what to do, and it was nuts.
I mean, how is that even, that just seems so impossible that that would happen.
And I believe that we communicated to the transport company that this was a stick shift car. Ahead of time, in one of the many conversations we had, I'm kind of sure they knew that. So,
but even still, if you're a car hauling professional and your job is to get all kinds of car vehicles on and off your ramp truck, you need to be well versed in how to do that, regardless of the vehicle. I mean, you could be like putting that 7 Series BMW all the way to like a full race car, if that's what happened, if that's what's going on.
Oh yeah,
and you need to be able to handle that. I mean, that's the professional part of car hauling professional, is being versed enough to do that.
Understanding the basics.
Yeah,
I mean, he could have had a C8 Corvette or something, you know, whatever.
Oh, God forbid.
I know.
Well, luckily
trying...
those are only all automatic, so.
Well, that's true. I think. They're trying to eliminate the manual shift option, but that doesn't mean that there's older cars that still have them. So,
right.
So that was kind of fun.
My Lord.
Yeah. And then another thing that kind of occurred this past week, which was actually cool and not sarcastically, is our good friend Yardley contacted us about doing some remote tuning on his 69 Riviera.
Nice.
So he's got a 462 cubic inch Buick, I believe, under the hood. The car's gone 1270s, I think, in the quarter. So it performs very well for being a big sled. And he put a Holley Sniper EFI system on it last year. And there's a little bit of a misnomer on those things and all these, you know, self-tuning EFI systems. The self-tuning part only comes in when you're driving the car and it's up to operating temperature and you're basically going down the road is when it starts refining its tune. It does not self-tune ignition timing, and it does not self-tune startup and cold start. And so you have to manually calibrate those through the software if you want to change that stuff.
Okay.
And that's what Yards was all about. He wasn't happy with the way the car started and just felt that maybe there was a little more in it. So he emailed me and he's like, can you help me out? And I said, sure. You know, so we put him and Trevor in touch, and Yardley emailed us his data log. And Trevor looked at it and made some changes to his calibration and emailed it back. And, you know, Yardley was able to install it and try it and, you know, made a little progress and let's try something else and sent it back. And we kind of went back and forth a few times. And finally, he sent me an email saying that the car was incredible and first gear is useless.
Oh, man.
In the wintertime, and it banged second and went sideways. And
right on.
It starts perfectly and you know, it goes to, you know, 1200 RPM, then 1000, and then below that, and kind of hangs there and doesn't stall or sputter or die. So that was a win.
Right on, Trevor. Good job, man.
Yeah. That's so killer. That was cool. So if you pick up one of those systems, you got to have an open mind on some of the non-cruising functions that you might have to mess with a little bit on your own, is the message there.
Well, that's why we have people like Trevor in the world that can get it dialed in nicely.
Yep, yep. A couple guys in our shop can do it.
Mm-hmm. That's killer, man.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So last week, our last episode, we touched on the Mecum auction and being in Kissimmee right now, and the it goes 10 days. Well, it's as of this recording, it's still going on. And did you see the Carroll Shelby personal Cobra go across the block today?
I didn't watch it go across, but I heard it put up a number.
It put up a big, big number. 5.4 million.
Holy cats.
Yeah. I think I was thinking about this, and just the if I got forwarded the buyer and seller's premium, I could retire, for crying out loud.
Just on that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just on that.
Well, man. from what I'm hearing, the Mecum, it's strong. There's cars getting good money.
That's awesome.
Which is pretty cool. It's an indicator that our hobby, and in my case, our industry, is strong. Mm-hmm. And there's interest, and people dig it, and they're willing to invest. There's also the flip side when people, you know, I often meet people that watch Muscle Car of the Week, and they give me a whole line about how, you know, those cars, you know, these $2, $3, or $5.5 million Cobras ruined it for everybody else. You know, mm-hmm. Regular guy, you will never get one. And that's true. But there is an afterglow. As long as those cars are fetching millions of dollars, there will be companies making parts for those cars, which you and I can buy.
Hey, right on.
If the Hemi Cuda convertibles of the world and that Carroll Shelby personal Cobra became worthless, then the aftermarket industry probably wouldn't stay around and our hobbies would go away. So
well, yeah,
even though...
Well, speaking of the Cobra, I mean, if that weren't a success, if that weren't valuable, you know, car companies like Factory 5 probably wouldn't be in existence reproducing them, because people do love them so much, and they are that popular, and they are that valuable. And mm-hmm. companies like that give you the opportunity to have something that's a pretty good replica for a fraction of the price.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's ways to have fun with something like that. That's not the real thing. That right. isn't $5.5 million. I did see another one. I saw a Superbird go across. I just saw a snapshot actually on my phone, but it was a white Hemi Superbird, and it went for $4.95, I think.
Good heavens!
So that was a pretty good number for one of those.
Yeah.
Which is great. Again, it. It makes all the rest of them, you know, it's like when your neighbor sells their house for a big number, it makes yours worth something, you know.
Yeah,
worth
it
more.
Makes your ears perk up. It's like, ooh, maybe we should sell too.
Yeah. So I'm definitely not in this for the money. I mean, you know, just like anything else, you know, what they say about racing or playing with cars in drag racing, you know, the fastest way to make $1 million in drag racing is to start with $2 million.
Right, right. You know? Or great. It's a great way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, there needs to be some kind of desire for this stuff, and it's super strong. And cars like the Cobras and the wing cars, and of course, you know, Camaros and Corvettes and I'm going to back out of Corvettes, but Camaros and Mustangs and Mopars, muscle cars in particular, happily are continuously being promoted by the entertainment industry. So, mm-hmm. you know, I won't say 9 times out of 10, but maybe 5 times out of 10, you know, the cool guy in your action adventure thriller movie is driving some kind of cool muscle car.
That's true.
You know, even like TV series, the Chicago Fire series, very popular TV show. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the guys had a fastback Mustang that he drove, which as his daily. And you and I both know kind of the nonsense of driving a 67 fastback Mustang in Chicago in the wintertime. in the snow.
Oh, cars, my goodness. It'll last one winter.
Yeah, and something happened to it. But as long as that is exposing the cars, though, to new viewers, new generations, uh-huh. new enthusiasts, I think the fun thing is they might see that Mustang and go, what is that? And then look at Mustangs and then their vision expands and they go, oh, well, here's Shelby's and here's, mm-hmm. you know, Mustangs from the 80s and whatever, and then eventually land on something. So,
yeah. Well, personally, I think a lot of people at Mecum listened to the show last week and realized that they do need these cars and they're willing to put some big money up for them.
Yeah, there you go.
So you affected change.
Oh, right. that little tangent was pretty well received. We had a lot of people that commented saying, hey, that was a good show. So mm-hmm. I'm glad.
It's killer. Well, it was a good show. It was a great topic.
I think it allowed everybody a little vindication. You know, they all kind of went, yeah, I do deserve this. You know?
Yeah.
Leave me alone.
Offered an alternative point of view that people really latched on to. So,
yeah. Nice. See, those guys said I need it, so I need it.
Honey, Kevin and Mike said I need it.
Right. Oh, man. So, there's a funny little tangent. This whole show is going to be nothing but tangents, folks. It's all over the place. I'm sorry.
Take it.
So, we have a parts manager. His name is Brian. I've mentioned him before. Brian's a very funny guy. And in our shop, we've been increasing our benefits package to our team members. So they've got health insurance and 401k and, you know, time off and holidays. And now we've added vision, dental insurance, and life insurance. So, you know, we want to make sure we take care of our team as best we can. And a couple guys opted for the life insurance plan. And Brian has, he's a G-Body fanatic. So he's got Monte Carlos and Malibus and stuff.
He's got that Monte Carlo SS, right?
Yep, the black one. It's good, great looking car. And he was talking to his wife about the insurance policy, the newly acquired life insurance policy. And he says, okay, so here's the deal. You know, you're the beneficiary. So if I happen to, you know, pass on, here's the plan. I want you to take my Malibu and take the money and bring it back to the VHB and resto shop and have those guys restore it in my honor. And as you can imagine, that went over real well.
Real well. It's in the will, babe. It's got to happen.
Yeah. I don't know that he wrote it in the will. I don't know if he's that.
Well, Brian, you should.
And the funny thing is, you know, he would only be enjoying it in spirit.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
We'd so all raise a stag to him.
That's right. That's right. But speaking of, you know, other feedback that we got on the last episode, we had talked a little bit about flat tappet cams.
Yes.
And, you know, kind of the scariness of starting a car with one. Well, a gentleman named Barry Beaugereau, I believe is how it's pronounced, wrote us a letter saying, hey, Kev, I was listening to your recent podcast and you touched on the subject of flat tappet cams. I have a 56 Bel Air with a 265. The engine was in the machine shop when I bought the car. It has the original cam, which is unique to the 265. I put new lifters in it when I finished the assembly of the engine. I don't remember if I used break-in procedures when I got it running. I probably did. I've had the car for 31 years and have had it running and driving for probably 25 years. I've only put 3,000 or 4,000 miles on it in that time. My question is, what kind of oil should I be using to protect the cam? Should I be using a ZDDP additive, or is there an oil that is formulated for this application? And also, should I always be adding a lead substitute to the gas to protect the valve seats? I love the podcasts. Good listening during my walk. So thank you for listening. We're glad that you can walk and listen to our nonsense and enjoy it. So there's a few interesting things going on there.
Yeah.
One is how unusual it is to reuse the cam on an engine rebuild.
Indeed, especially a flat tappet cam.
Yeah.
To reuse. I mean, I can understand reusing a roller cam if it's typically, it'll probably won't be very much wear on it. And typically they would be reusable, but a flat tappet, ugh.
And putting new lifters in it.
And new lifters. That's the scary part to me. Because that cam, depending on how many miles it had on it before, has already worn itself in and has a wear pattern based on the lifter that was on its mating surface before. And introducing a new lifter is going to have a fresh mating surface. And to me, I would think that that would be a recipe for disaster, and that would cause accelerated wear of the cam lobes.
Well, you would think. Looking at this this story and this question, though, there's some interesting things going on. So first of all, back in the day, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when all cars were flat tappet cams, there were jobs that local mechanics would do replacing lifters if, you know, one was sticking all the time or, mm-hmm. you know, it was collapsing. So putting a new lifter on an existing cam is not that, or was not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think the key here is that he's had this car for 31 years, meaning it's got parts on it that were made at least 30 years ago.
Okay.
And I think that's the key to his success, because I believe in the good old days, cams and lifters were manufactured with, you know, not using recycled steel and some of the problems that we saw with modern flat tappet lifters. I just think they were better, you know, back in the day.
Okay.
So I think he has that going for him. The next thing he's got going for him is that he only puts 3,000 or 4,000 miles on it in 25 years.
That's crazy. That's something.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's kind of tragic at the same time. You know, maybe he's got other cars to drive. Maybe this thing is pristine and, you know, he's got his reasons no matter what, which is fine.
Certainly.
But
absolutely.
For our little story here, he, knowing he has the good parts in it and not driving it very much, you know, I think that is why his cam is probably still happy today.
Could be.
But I certainly would suggest using either a ZDP additive or one of the oils that has that contained in it already blended. And if you want, you know, one of the cheapest, easiest additives is good old-fashioned STP oil treatment.
That could work.
The little blue bottle. And they make a white one, a white bottle, I think, that is for higher mileage cars, too, that has a gasket. You know, it's a stop leak function. It softens the gaskets, you know, so
help them swell a little bit to stop leaking or something.
Yep, exactly. But that's loaded with ZDDP, and it's only like $4, you know, for a bottle.
Oh, right on.
It's like honey. It comes out, you know, super thick.
Oh, yeah, it is pretty thick stuff.
Yeah.
For warm weather use only, folks.
Well, yeah, but, you know, in a pinch, it's a great option.
Right on.
But typically, we like to use a synthetic product. It's Royal Purple HPS synthetic oil, which is a full synthetic, but it also is loaded with ZDDP and then a couple other additives that Royal Purple makes to help these engines stay happy with flat tappet camshafts. So I think it certainly can't hurt to use the additive. But I think, you know, not driving the car very often and knowing what we know about what's in it, it's probably going to be fine if you don't. But I would.
There you go.
And I think the second part of the question, should I always be adding a lead substitute to the gas to protect the valve seats? This is another thing that that occurred, right? So right. When that car was new, gasoline had lead in it.
Uh-huh.
And lead was one of the things the lead did was lubricate the valve seats and cushion them as they closed. And it provided some lubrication for the pivots in the rockers, and you know, it was just additional lubrication. And uh-huh. When leaded gas went away, everybody panicked, saying my heads are going to be shot because that lubrication and protection is gone.
Sure.
And it happens for sure. And I think during the transition period of when lead gasoline went away, there was still many cars that were designed for the lead gas on the road.
True.
As people's daily drivers, you know, right. So that the when did the lead go out of the gasoline? Like 82 or?
Oh, completely gone. No, it was later than that.
Another trivia question here.
Yeah, I think when lead was, when you went, it used to be when you got regular gas, it was leaded gas.
Right.
And now it's to the point where you get regular gas, that means 87 octane, but everything's unleaded or has some ethanol in it. And I think that official changeover happened, I want to say 85 or 86.
Okay.
Because I think I still remember seeing some leaded gas pumps when I was in high school back then.
Mm-hmm. So 85, it was not uncommon to see a 1975 Ford station wagon going down the road.
You know? True.
And if you're driving it every day and you switch to unleaded, didn't change anything else, and you put another 50,000 miles on it, you're risking those valve seats recessing and some possible damage. I think In this case, once again, if you've driven 3,000 or 4,000 miles in 25 years.
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely not.
And one of the key things he says is, should I always be adding a lead substitute to the gas? And, you know, this car doesn't even get a chance probably to drain a tank of gas.
You know, yeah.
I think he fills it up and the gas probably goes bad by, you know, before it's gone.
Yeah, maybe uses one tank a year, if that.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. So, you know, adding stuff to it all the time, I don't think is necessary. But every once in a while, it wouldn't be bad, you know. So maybe every second year on that tank,
right?
Throw in a bottle of lead substitute and you should be fine.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that.
Yeah. And the disclaimer is, you know, Q-Ball and I are not, you know, certified gasolineologists, but using our experience and common sense, this is kind of what we determined.
But we did stay at a Holiday Inn Express.
Yes, this is true. So, Barry, we appreciate it.
Thank you, Barry.
Yes, thanks for listening, and a great question. Definitely.
It is. Did I miss it? What kind of car was it?
It's a 56 Chevy.
56 Chevy, okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I saw a picture of it. It's like a red and cream two-tone, or red and white, Bel Air. It's nice.
So that a V8 car?
Yeah, 265 V8.
265, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Right on.
So, yeah, and we got another interesting letter, and this is one that people ask all the time that warrants some conversation. So a gentleman named John Arellano wrote, he said, "Hello, I'm looking into a 69 Camaro Restomod. My problem is I don't know where to start. Number one, do I buy a fairly restored car and have a shop tear it all apart to restore it to my liking and modify it to my liking? Or do I buy an unrestored car and start that way? Which would be more cost effective? I only ask this question because I could buy a $45,000 to $60,000 car and have a shop tear it apart to my liking, or get an $8,000 to $15,000 car and start from the beginning that way." And he says, "I appreciate any advice." So what do you think? What do you think is the best way to go?
What I think is the best way to go, and what I would suggest for anybody that wants to have a car built to their spec, is to start with the most solid car you could find that's going to require the least amount of body work to get to the shape that you want. So if this $8,000 to $15,000 car is rust-free and has good bones and has the equipment you want on it, or the ability to get the equipment you want on it, I would go with that. I wouldn't spend $40,000 to $60,000 on a car that's going to be blown apart like the $8,000 to $15,000 car is, just to build it the way you want. To me, that's poor spending habits if you buy the $40,000 to $60,000 car. That's what Q-Ball thinks.
Well, I agree with you. You know, and first of all, you're probably not going to find an $8,000 to $15,000 '69 Camaro with no rust and good bones.
I'm just saying if.
Yeah. So the buy-in is going to be a little bit more than that. Mm-hmm. I think the ideal goal is, of course, the Holy Grail car that we're all looking for, which is, in this case, a '69 Camaro that is all original, that's never been messed with, and never rusted and never wrecked, that has, you know, a small block V8 in it, and it's just ready for restoring and modifying in a manner that you're suggesting, you know, without requiring tons and tons of metalwork and, you know, no surprises. Part of the problem, and you would think, you know, kind of along the lines of our friend that bought this black 76 Corvette, you know, he found kind of what he wanted, and then we modified it and sent it down the road. Well, one of the differences, his buy-in was far less just because of the market on the car.
Right.
But the risk, I mean, you might think that it's a good idea to say, well, look, I want a 69 Camaro. I know I want a red one. And I know I want, you know, big wheels and big brakes. Mm-hmm. And I want an LSA engine under the hood. And you go out and find a $50,000 restored car that has everything but the engine.
Okay.
So then you take it somewhere like to our shop and we change the drivetrain out for you. And at the end of the day, you know, you're in it for just for round numbers, say 75, and you have exactly what you want. The problem with that sometimes is that a lot of restored cars that, especially the very popular ones like 69 Camaros and Mustangs and Chevelles and, you know, some of the Mopars, of course, is that there are some unscrupulous people out there who will kind of cobble these things together and make them look real straight, real shiny, and sound real nice, and put a fairly hefty price tag on it and sell it to an unassuming enthusiast who buys it thinking it's done, only to find that it needs to be redone.
Sure. It's like 400 pounds heavier than it should be because of all the Bondo that's on it.
Yeah, I mean, it starts cracking and the cool stuff under the hood doesn't work together and paint's peeling. Right. And once you start stripping it, you find rust and all the rest. And then you go, oh, man. So then you spent all that money and still have to do it again because, you know, you can't really sell something like that if you've torn it apart, you know, and expect to get your money back out of it. Mm-hmm. So the flip side to that is if you know somebody who has a lot of experience with this stuff, who can look at the car that you're going to purchase, you know, so if that $50,000 Camaro we're talking about, if John here called us and said, hey, this thing's in your neighborhood, can you go take a look at it? We could look at it and know within 5 minutes if this thing has been, you know,
if it's legit or not.
Well, yeah. And no, there's telltale signs of quarter panel installation and trunk floor and, you know, all the cabin floor and the body quality and all that stuff. And not to say that we would be Superman with X-ray vision and be able to tell you everything about it, but we'd probably find enough red flags quickly to say, hey, maybe this isn't the one. or we'd look at it and go, you know what, this car is a sweetheart and it's worth it. But buying a car from a picture on the internet doesn't do it. So
that's got to be the scariest thing ever, to buy a car that, and you've only seen pictures of it. And then when you get it, you got it, good or bad.
Yep.
So that's, that frightens me.
Well, and you know, you can buy from a reputable dealer, but the dealers, they've got fine print everywhere. You know, they're not responsible for the car. They didn't build the car. It's a consignment shop. Somebody brought it to them and they're selling it for them. So they're trying to get their commission on top of the selling price. Mm-hmm.
So it's not really in their best interest to not get you to buy the car. They want you to buy the car. And I don't want to say they don't care, but I don't think they're really keeping a wide eye for any shenanigans going on with the car.
Yeah, and a lot of these places, in their defense, they try not to take in cars that are problematic, you know.
Sure.
Because there is a process. You know, they'll look at it and say, that thing, I can tell from here that, you know, it's a mess, and we're not comfortable reselling that.
Yeah, they don't want a reputation of selling junky cars.
Correct. Sure. So, and some of them will work with you, if you buy something and have a problem with it right away, you know, they'll work with you on it that way. But I still think the best thing to do is find somebody who knows the particular car, make and model that you're interested in, and get them to take a look at it. And, you know, there's Facebook groups for 69 Camaro fanatics, and those people are in every state, in every city. And there's a good chance you might be able to connect with somebody and say, hey, I'll give you $100 if you go take a look at this car for me. And you know, let me buy your expertise for a couple hours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, might save you $50,000 down the road. So it's totally worth it.
Sounds good. Sounds like a good plan.
There you go. So thank you to Mr. John Arellano for writing in with that one.
That's good stuff. Yeah. Thank you, John. Thanks for listening.
So have you, here's another random update, but as we're recording this, again, it's January and it's cold outside, but I'm very fortunate. I got to do a shout out to my lovely and talented wife, Kelly, for providing me with a wonderful Christmas present that just got installed today. And it's a new gas heater in the garage.
Woo-hoo!
So, yeah.
No more torpedo heater.
Yeah, no more kerosene torpedo heater, you know, making me high on fumes. So a while back, we had our top five garage.
Oh, yeah.
Aspirations. Yeah. And heat was one of them on both our lists. And I can check that off the list now. So
yeah. Very cool. You know what? This is motivating me now because I have a heater, but I haven't installed it yet. Mm-hmm. It's an electric heater. I got to run a 240 line and get it mounted. Why don't I just do that? God dang it.
That's something you should just do.
The heck's the matter with me?
I got an idea.
Yeah.
You should install the heater.
You should install the heater before the next show.
Yeah, we'll see.
Oh, brother.
It's not like you got nothing else to do, you know. But
yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
But it's a good wintertime inside project, you know.
It is. And the garage doesn't get too terrible, which is nice. It stays about 20 to 30 degrees warmer in the garage than it is outside. So it's not bad.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can live with that.
Have you set a date to get your GTO engine screwed back together?
Sunday. I'm going to
Up in a couple days from now.
Yep. So by the time this is theoretically released and people are listening, I could be right now putting that engine together.
You could be listening to this show, putting your engine together.
I could be. Maybe I will be.
As we're talking about putting your engine together.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that just blow everyone's mind?
Oh, my gosh. I think we're going to have to end the show on that.
Oh, heavens.
That just bent the space-time continuum.
It totally did. There's no gravity now because of that.
Yeah. Well, that'll be cool. I'm sure you're going to take a few snapshots.
Yeah, for sure.
Keep us apprised on how that process goes. Hopefully. Absolutely. Nice and smooth.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. And I'm really looking forward to this weekend, so this will be great. This has been a long time coming.
Yep. Heck yeah. And on my end, people gave me a hard time about heating up my model kit and twisting the chassis.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I got good news. My replacement chassis came in the mail from eBay, so maybe I can finish that one.
As Hallelujah. Right on.
Practice dry run, because I got to build that 53 Chevy panel gasser, and I can't screw that one up. So.
Oh, yeah. That's the real deal right there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I know that there are people wondering about our trivia questions.
They're wondering what AVS stands for.
Yeah, and where they can drive the fastest. So,
right.
You go first.
All right, Kev. I asked you about the Carter AFB and AVS carburetor, and what does AFB and AVS stand for? And you said the AFB stands for aluminum four barrel, and that is absolutely correct.
Hey, right on.
And
however,
with the AVS, you were kind of hemming and hawing between aluminum and automatic vacuum secondaries, and you settled on aluminum. And again, Kevin, you are correct.
Hey, wow.
Hey, how about it?
Hey, fantastic.
Nicely done. And thank you, Frank, again for the question.
Yes. Frank's got a lot of them.
Yeah, he does. Smart guy.
All right. So I pose this one to you saying, what is the highest posted speed limit in the world and where is it located? And your guess was the German Autobahn. Which, unfortunately...
Come on.
it's not the highest posted speed limit. I will tell you where it is, and then I will tell you some other stuff.
All right.
Actually, there's only one country in the world that has no speed limits.
Is that right?
Yes, and that is the Isle of Man.
Ooh, that is a nutty race.
The Isle of Man race is insane, but knowing now that there's no speed limits, that's legal, that race.
<You know? laughs> Oh, man.
That's just like a Sunday ride.
Yeah.
Mm. If you've never seen the Isle of Man motorcycle race, you need to jump on YouTube and watch that now.
Good gravy. That is, whoo, just makes your blood run cold.
Yeah, those guys
do that.
There are areas of the German Autobahn which have only advisory speed limits, known as Rückgeschwindigkeit, which...
Wow, you came prepared for that.
It's German for recommended speed.
Uh-huh.
So they recommend speeds, so they're posted. But the highest posted speed limit in the world is 160 kilometers per hour, or 99 miles an hour, which applies to two motorways in the United Arab Emirates.
Ooh, really?
So the home of Dubai, yeah.
Pretty
crazy.
Man.
And those guys love their performance cars, man.
They really do. Yeah. They really do. They do love to drive fast, and they like those cars.
Yeah, and Even classics and muscle cars, there's a real strong culture over there, and they really dig them. So it'd be fun to know. I don't know anything really about that road, but they have so many new nice flat roads out there that go for miles and miles through the desert. I bet that's a really good time.
I bet it's a great time, man. That'd be something.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You've had a customer from Dubai, haven't you?
A couple of them. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, the ZR9 Corvette lives there, or I'm sorry, the ZR9 Camaro.
Yeah,
that 69 we built, and and actually this black Corvette, that's where it's going.
Oh, right on. That's cool.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll race together.
I know who's going to win.
Yeah, no doubt. Nice.
And we sent another car there, a 68 Firebird. That kind of ties this whole thing together. It was a 68 Firebird. The customer lived in Dubai, but he was from England originally.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought the car online through a local classic car dealer. and he purchased the car and found us because he needed air conditioning installed. Because if you live in Dubai, it's very hot, obviously, in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And our shop is a distributor and installer for Vintage Air, so we're on their website. So he finds us, and we go to the classic car dealership and actually pick the car up for him and bring it to our shop and kind of looked at it and went through it. We put the air conditioning in it and fixed a bunch of things that he was unaware of when he purchased the car, which was a bummer.
Oh, jeez.
But nothing major. I mean, it was a good car.
And, good. I'm glad.
And that one got shipped over there. So maybe he's out driving up to 99 miles an hour right now.
Maybe, but not a kilometer over.
That's right. or else.
Or else. Yeah. Oh, brother.
All right, man. Well, this was kind of a fun shotgun approach to a podcast, a little bit all
Indeed.
Over the place. But sometimes you got to do that.
Yeah. We're just talking. It's all good.
That's right. Short attention span theater today. V8 Radio.
Theater of the mind.
That's right. So, again, we encourage the feedback. We appreciate it. And if you'd like to subscribe and leave us a rating, we kind of dig those ratings. We got a lot of 5-star ratings on iTunes, which is fantastic.
That's great.
Yeah. Always happy to get those.
Thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And I guess until next time, man, maybe we'll get the engine assembly update.
For sure. For sure.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold you to it.
All right. Dig.
All right. So you heard it here first. Cue Ball's motor comes together on the next episode of V8 Radio. I'm Kevin Oostie for Mike Clark saying thanks for listening, and I can't wait to hear that story.